At the grand AAAS meeting, they revisited geoengineering, now renamed albedo reduction. Sounds safer, doesn't it? That's to reduce sunlight arriving at the Earth's surface. We've talked about this before, but a panel at AAAS responded to an American Academy of Science report just out.
In 2007, the AAAS had a big symposium in San Diego, and the headline from that was, "Climate Engineers Agree to Disagree." But our committee reached consensus, and we were a deliberative process that we think that what you have from the reports in front of you are what we actually agreed upon. We also think that there's been progress on the social discussions of this. So I'm a historian, and I think there's been precedents in the past that help us think about this more clearly. John F. Kennedy called on Nikita Khrushchev to cooperate on weather control in 1961 in his message to the United Nations. We need to generate that kind of social, historical, cultural, and social science research to go along with our recommendations. We have not developed the mechanisms for that yet, but we do recommend that there be ongoing deliberations. And you can find the roots of this recommendation in the American Meteorological Society's and American Geophysical's Union statement about 5 years ago that said we need to also go along with the technical research, we need to go along with the governance deliberations, we need to have robust discussions. We didn't have the authority to recommend a United Nations international kind of discussion, but we do think we should model and harvest the best practices. And coming out of this in a long-term way, we really do recommend that climate intervention needs to have the sort of fresh air, sunlight discussion amongst the policymakers. But we've been struggling because there is nothing yet to make the policy about, except that we should really be careful.
I welcome this recommendation of the panel that we do research, because I think we have to know if policymakers ever consider using geoengineering, what the benefits and risks might be. I work on the area of stratospheric aerosols to emulate a volcanic eruption. I'll show a list of 5 potential benefits of that and 26 potential risks. How can we do research on this? One way is with climate models. Some people say, I don't believe climate models, but then, of course, why are they even worried about global warming? And I've conducted a climate model intercomparison project. Another way is to look at the closest natural analog, which is large volcanic eruptions. They are imperfect, but they're the best analog, and so we can study the impacts of past eruptions and learn a lot about the potential benefits and risks. But that leaves a lot of things on my list that can't be investigated with either of those, including governance issues and issues of conflict between countries. And so there may be a lot of things that we can't quantify which will stand in the way of ever implementing geoengineering.
Thanks. I will report this afternoon on the results of 3 studies that have been conducted over the last 3 years on the topic of Earth observations. Let me preface this by saying these were forward-looking research studies by myself and my collaborators. This is not the result of an official NASA assessment. But briefly, those 3 studies looked at the following types of potential drivers for observational needs. 1, passive studies of natural analogs, such as large volcanic eruptions and ship tracks. 2, potential observational needs to support field research programs for albedo modification. And 3, if a global albedo monitoring system were put in place to track experiments or full-scale deployment. That was the scope of these 3 studies. They were conducted at the Keck Institute for Space Studies at Caltech in 2011, at Harvard University in spring of last year, and a joint JPL-Boeing study last year. And just lumping the findings together from those 3 studies, 1, current observational systems were not designed to detect, attribute, or monitor geoengineering activity. And a particular challenge is disentangling the effects of natural variability in the Earth's albedo and human attempts to modify it. That remains a key challenge. Secondly, passive studies of natural analogs of geoengineering are complicated by observational gaps, and we're currently not prepared to monitor the next large volcanic eruption in terms of its impacts on the upper atmosphere, and more could be done to do that. 3, any consideration of the observational implications and risk associated with potential field research programs should consider the potentially enormous range of physical scales, energies, and materials involved. And the reason we say that is the smaller scale experiments that have been looked at likely fall within precedent of existing atmospheric research in terms of their observability and risk, whereas larger scale experiments push science into unprecedented territory.
I'm Steve Gardner, University of Washington. So I think we find ourselves here on a strange day, and we're here to witness two relationships that seem to be in serious trouble, one between humanity and the global environment, and another one between the scientific community and the rest of the public and our governance systems around doing things about climate change. We may even be at the beginning of divorce proceedings on one or both of these. And so it's tempting to think we might even be at the beginning of an important moment in human history. I'm here, I guess, as an ethicist, as a moral and political philosopher, as a kind of marriage counselor of sorts, but I'm here pretty late in the game. But the thing that's in front of us is a report about albedo modification intended as a kind of stopgap measure on the road to long-term repair of some of those relationships. It's like a trial separation, if you like, between humanity and the rest of nature. The National Academy is recommending modest steps in this direction, coupled with a great deal of skepticism and trepidation. A lot of that, I think, seems appropriate. One of the things they're recommending, as the earlier Royal Society report recommended, was further social and especially ethical research on how to think about this problem and how to go about governing it if we do take a step towards modification. I just want to close with a couple of thoughts about why that sort of ethical reflection might be necessary. People often frame geoengineering interventions of this sort as if they're going to be good for everybody, or they're just necessary because we face a planetary emergency. There's something we have to do. We have to ward off catastrophe. I think one of my take-home messages is going to be we need to be careful about some of that rhetoric, because there's a real potential that modification in particular might actually make things worse, especially for people in the future. It's easy to see why the current generation might be tempted by a cheap short to medium term fix that makes things better, holds off the worst for, I don't know, 50, 70, 100 years or so, but at the cost of making things much worse in the future. I've argued elsewhere that climate change in general manifests this kind of incentive pattern, what I call a tyranny of the contemporary, and that's why it's a major intergenerational problem. It's also quite plausible we'll be seduced by what are sometimes called technological imaginaries in the climate case, but also might be social and ethical imaginaries. It's easy to highlight the political inertia, what's gone wrong in the past, as a motivation for doing modification, but not to think through what the lingering effects of that political inertia might mean for even trying to do albedo modification.
That was Stephen Gardner from the University of Washington. The panel also included James Fleming, Riley Duren, Chief Systems Engineer from NASA at JPL, and Jim Russell. Alan Robock was also there from Rutgers. One of the questions that arose is whether having geoengineering, as we sometimes call it, is in fact giving an insurance policy for people just to carry on regardless. You talked about your interactions with the public and their response. What was it?
If I tell people I'm working on geoengineering, they say, well, what's that? Most people don't even know what it is. And when I explain it, they say, wow, you're thinking about doing something that crazy? Maybe global warming really is a problem. Maybe I should really consider global warming more seriously. And there's been academic research that shows that that's the reaction to people. If they see that you're actually planning or thinking about these engineering responses, there must be a real problem.
Yes, indeed, because sometimes geoengineering is put up as something that you can do, but the way it will happen is in a real emergency situation where people suddenly realize they're in deep, deep trouble, and it may be launched rather quickly before you've actually worked out what consequences may be.
You couldn't do it today because the technology doesn't exist. So even if somebody wanted to control the world's climate, it would be a decade or more before the technology could be developed and tested. We don't even know if it's possible to do it. We don't know if you can brighten clouds over the ocean. You might brighten them and they would get darker nearby because the air would be sinking and that would negate the effect. We don't know if you can create particles in the stratosphere of the desired size. They might end up being too big and they would fall out more quickly, and you'd have to put 10 or more times as much material as we think now as a volcano does. And so those questions are interesting questions, and we should find out even if it's even possible. That's why some research should be done.
What about mirrors, you know, the huge scale of mirrors up there?
The idea of putting mirrors in space is considered to be extremely expensive and extremely questionable about how if it's even possible. So I don't know if anybody is taking that seriously in terms of...
There was an experiment about 2 years ago suggested by the people in Cambridge of putting water vapor up there with a balloon.
The SPICE experiment was testing a delivery mechanism of having a blimp in the stratosphere with a hose that would take the SO2 up there. And so to test that, they proposed having a blimp with a hose only 1 kilometer long and spraying water, a completely innocuous substance, up to test the technology. Because you're worried about the hose twisting and pressure differences and stuff. But when the public found out that that was the plan, there was so much protest and there were patent issues that they ended up not even doing that.
So the chances of experimenting as you might like are severely limited by that sort of public response, perhaps.
If you want to do outdoor experiments, even at a small scale, they have to be clearly explained what the question is, what you're looking into, and there has to be some sort of governance to evaluate the environmental impact statement, and there has to be monitoring independent of the scientists, and such a structure just doesn't exist. But there, as you say, there may be a public outcry about it as a slippery slope toward deployment that may stop it.
What about your own experiments in this regard?
All my experiments are indoors in a computer with numerical modeling, and I haven't gotten any protests about those, but we're just doing climate modeling, using the same climate models that calculate how climate will change in the future with increasing greenhouse gases.
My final question, and you refer to governance. These days you can hardly get the United Nations to agree on anything, and with all due respect, here in the United States, Obama said, yes, we can. Well, clearly, no, we can't. The question is whether you can get governance effectively on something quite so huge and controversial.
I think it would be very difficult. In fact, I've written an article about this, and my speculation is that it'll never happen because the government's problems will be insoluble. Another way of saying it is, whose hand would be on the thermostat for the planet? And some countries in the tropics right now might want it even cooler than it is now because sea level rise is flooding their islands. Countries in the north, Russia, Canada, might not mind it a couple degrees warmer because they can spend less money heating their homes and exploit the resources in the Arctic Ocean. And I think getting global agreement on what the temperature of the planet should be would be very difficult.
Thank you so much.
Okay, you're welcome.
Alan Robock is a distinguished professor at Rutgers University in New Jersey. And this is The Science Show on RN.